Jimmy, Jimmy who reigns, Jimmy who reigns on earth. Jimmy who reigns in improv. Jimmy who reigns on earth. Oh, Jimmy, Jimmy, Jimmy,
Jimmy who reigns,
Jimmy who reigns.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and we are sponsored today by Acting Studio Chicago. Now, Acting Studio Chicago has been training Chicago actors for over 3 decades with a wide variety of acting on camera and audition classes designed for beginners as well as professionals. Classes are challenging and practical and taught by working pros. ASC is especially welcoming to improvisers who have skill and performance experience but would benefit enormously from learning to attack text and ask the script questions that lead to dynamic, active choices. Shirtlift's 12 guideposts can give improvisers a leg up when it comes to scripted auditions. All you need to do for more information is go to actingstudiochicago.com. Summer registration is now open, so go to actingstudiochicago.com. We're also sponsored by the 13th Annual LA Improv Comedy Festival, which is running August 2nd through the 8th at the iOS Theater in Hollywood. It features shows running simultaneously on 3 stages, including Herald, Cage Match, Duos, stand-up competition, celebrity headliners and judges, as well as a variety of comedy workshops and panels. The festival will also feature the 7-day show, setting the world record for the largest continuous improv show at 150 hours straight. The Chris Farley House is the festival's official beneficiary. Submission deadline is June 5th. So go to ioimprov.com/west. That's ioimprov.com/west for submissions. Also, if you've always wanted to study with me, Jimmy Corain, in my award-winning improv classes, The Artist Low Comedy, and you're going to be in Chicago in July, I'm offering 2 Artist Low Comedy Intensives, where we teach you before you can be funny, you need to be real. And guess what? You're going to be even funnier. I'll be offering the Artist Low Comedy Intensives on July 11th and 12th, the weekend of, and then the weekend of July 25th and 26th. For more information, to sign up immediately, spaces are still available. All you need to do is go to my website, my slick new website, at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. We have another great episode for you today, but when do we not have a great episode, really? You're probably getting me tired of saying that. This episode, we went all the way down to Austin, Texas, and recorded at the Cold Town Theater. Our guest today is Dave Buckman. He is a director, teacher, improviser, actor. He started out in Chicago, where he studied, taught, and performed before becoming the artistic director for Boom Chicago in Amsterdam. He then came back to Chicago to direct at the Second City before moving to Austin, Texas in 2005, where he teaches, directs, and performs. He also produces the Out of Bounds Comedy Festival. We talked to Dave about directing at the Second City in Boom Chicago, why the Austin improv scene gets along so well, and what's it like for him to perform with his wife, Rachel. Before we get to the episode with Dave, I just want to give, I know some people have been asking where Lauren and I are in the whole pregnancy, about, you know, pregnancy meaning getting a baby or having a baby. We are on our 5th or 6th fertility treatment, and we're going to do it in the next week or so. This one's a little more intense because Lauren has to give herself shots at night, like 3 shots, one in the stomach and one in the thigh. And that totally makes me uncomfortable, and I'm really afraid about that. And I had to go and freeze my sperm, and they charge you $400 just to freeze your sperm, which you could buy a refrigerator for that. So, of course, you know, that brings up all the trust issues, like, oh, they're ripping me off. But so we are going to probably next week, my sperm will go into her egg. She's explained that to me because I don't know where I was during sex ed. She keeps saying, you know, you don't understand this stuff. This is how pregnancy works. What were you doing during sex ed? I can tell you what I was doing during sex ed. I was laughing because I was embarrassed and felt a lot of shame. And I was probably making a lot of jokes, so I didn't pay attention to it at all. Plus, I wasn't a good student. So if you're wondering where I was during sex ed, I was fucking around, like I was doing in every other class that I was taking. So here it is. You're going to love this episode, all the way from Austin, Texas, in Cold Town Theater, the Dave Buckman episode. Enjoy.
He's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah.
Thank you so much for bringing me back down again.
Thank you for coming.
You're a big fan of Improv Nerd, and I really appreciate it. Huge supporter. And it's great to be here at Cold Town Theater.
Thank you for coming.
Let us start with you growing up in South Jersey.
Yes.
And you were a big class clown.
Mm-hmm.
And you really got in trouble for being a goof. What kind of things did you get in trouble for being a goof?
Distracting my classmates, mainly. Derailing teachers' concentrations, you know what I mean? Nothing was funnier to me, or more fun to me, than making my friends, my immediate circle of friends, laugh, who were all funnier than me, and probably still are very much funnier than me.
But, I mean, this distraction thing, like, it got you kicked out of school, right?
It got me kicked out of several classes. I did get kicked out of that school eventually.
For, you remember?
Yeah, I remember. It was, I'm going to say general mischief.
Okay, that's what they wrote it down. But,
no, it was, okay. It was more than that. There was a big incident.
Do you want to go into it?
Are
you... That was like... That had to be, what, like 25 years ago?
My 25th anniversary was last weekend.
Of that incident.
Of that school.
If you don't want to go into it, I totally respect it. But do you feel like a little embarrassed about talking about it?
I'm not embarrassed. I've told people before.
Okay.
So, you know... We used to get to the school during the school dances. Would be in one building. We'd go run around the school while they were going on because we were bored. And we did that a couple of times. And one time, some of my friends, I left early because I was, I lived right by the school. And some of them had decided, we're going to crash at the school and go home in the morning. And they ended
Sleep
at the school. They ended up stealing some musical equipment.
Mm-hmm. How did you end up in a Quaker school? Because they have a very specific
way. Yeah, so in the Northeast, there's these friends schools.
Mm-hmm.
They're very just really good private schools.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just happened to be one of the best ones. And I had a lot of aptitude. I tested highly in kindergarten. So, like, let's get this kid in a private school. And
were you pretty smart as a kid or one of those, like, most improvisers didn't apply themselves?
I was very smart and didn't apply myself, yeah. I got pretty much B-minus, C-plus grades my entire academic career.
Probably didn't study at all.
Did not read a book. I was doing homework at 8 in the morning, just getting it done. I like math. Math is a lot of fun.
And your mom was a feminist activist.
Mm-hmm. It still is.
Okay. And what you told me about this, what does that mean?
That means she was the president of her NOW chapter, and still is.
NOW is?
National Organization for Women.
Okay.
She marched on Washington for the Equal Rights Amendment. I went with her. I used to go on abortion rights marches. I used to protect women from screaming nuns, helping them get into abortion provider clinics. I picketed conglomerates on weekends, and that was either that or going to my dad's store and work for the weekends.
And your dad stole. He had a women's clothing store, right?
Two in Philadelphia,
but not in a great section of
Philadelphia. Terrible section called Kensington, where most hookers and junkies are.
So your parents said you're either going to do this march or you're going to do this protest or you have to work.
Not every single weekend, but that was the majority of my my high school weekends. Yeah,
you're okay with that. You don't look back and go, "Oh, my."
No, I'm glad I got to work and I got paid. You know, my dad would pay me at the end of a shift. You know, I barely worked. Like, I would do inventory and then go play pinball down the street for an hour or two, and then come back and take a nap in the clothes. You know, I mean, it wasn't that hard.
And what about with your mom when you would do a march? Would you march for like 10 minutes and go play pinball?
No, I would do the whole thing. I think when I was really young, you'd get tired from the parades and I'd have to be carried. But for the most part, I was happy to spend time with my mom.
Now, as a guy, did your friends give you shit for that? Like, oh, I can't believe you're doing a feminist march.
I don't think anybody knew.
Mm-hmm. That's what did happened. You want to keep it secret?
That's not that I wanted to keep it secret. We just, you know, everybody, going to that private school, you know, it was, they were in a, it was a different town.
Mm-hmm.
So all my friends where I lived knew, but you know, no one at that school mm-hmm. knew that that's what my nobody knew what anybody's home life was like because we did, all lived in separate towns.
And then you go to American University, mm-hmm. and you start doing short form.
Mm-hmm.
And your junior year, I believe, you took a workshop with Michael Gelman.
Yes.
And it was like in Virginia or something at that time.
Yep.
And you said it was life-changing.
It was.
What was life-changing about it?
That I was good at something. That I felt confident doing something. And I was so jazzed after that... after that workshop, I was just like, what do I do now? And he said, just keep doing it. You know, I remember him taking an improv cup, like an invisible cup, after an object work exercise, and walking it over to the other side of the room and just placing it down on an actual table. I don't think he realized he was doing that, but I was like, oh my God, he's actually thought he had a cup in his hand. And it blew my mind.
And the other thing that happened at that workshop was you connected... You love Saturday Night Live. You mm-hmm. loved SCTV, mm-hmm. and you then connected it with Second City in yeah. Chicago, which you had never realized, right?
Yeah, there was the ad was like Second City alumni, and I just knew that there was something called Second City. All my heroes had come from this place called Second City. I didn't know what they did. I didn't know what Second City was. I just knew that all these people had come from there, and I was like, oh, I got to go take a workshop with this guy, and the connection was there. Like, that's what I need to be doing. This is what I need to be getting better at.
So, does that plant the seed to go to Chicago?
It definitely plants the seed, absolutely. I think it took another 2 years to get me out there.
And so then what do you do in those 2 years?
I start a short-form troupe on campus.
You're smiling when you say that.
Yeah. What do you mean?
You like? Are you looking back as it's fondly or like, oh, I did the short-form and I...
No, I mean, I'm proud of my short-form background. It was a great education in dealing with audiences.
In what way?
Because the audiences are so much more invested in what's happening on stage. When long form, you take one suggestion, you go for half an hour, they can check out, mm-hmm. especially if they didn't even provide the suggestion. But short form, they're constantly getting their voice into the show. So you learn to kind of play to those voices.
Is that why it's an audience favorite over long form?
I think so. I think the audience is more emotionally invested. Everybody has a stake in the scene. You know, they have a more shot of being a part of the show.
It's almost like they're almost like in a conversation in a
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
Then you move to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
After a couple of years, mm-hmm. you stay at American University 2 years after you had graduated.
Yes, I did.
How do you feel about that?
I was the guy on I was working on a video store on campus, and running the improv troupe.
Which I'm sure together you made about $300 a week.
Absolutely. I was living with six guys. Uh-huh. Six of my fraternity brothers.
Okay.
And and we would just do shows Thursday nights, and that was like the highlight of my week.
How was that like? Oh, do you ever look back? I should have moved on.
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. I should have.
Why do you think you stayed?
You know what? Because I'm very comfortable being the oldest person in the community. I think I've been that person in a lot of different communities. And when I haven't been, I've kind of floundered a little bit, like Chicago, like Boom Chicago. I've kind of mm-hmm. floundered a little bit, not being the most.
What is it that you like about being the oldest? The senior.
I don't know. I think it's, I have an easier time. I just have an easier time.
So you come to Chicago.
Yeah.
And really quickly you become a host at Second City.
Yeah.
Which means you see people, you do some, you know, other things, right?
Bar back, restocking.
And that's where you meet Ike Barinholtz.
Yes.
Now Ike, at this point, he's not allowed to deal with the public.
No, he's in the kitchen now.
Why is he in the kitchen?
Because he's not allowed to be with the audience members. I don't know. He was always in the kitchen by the time I got there.
But
I probably to keep an eye on him because he probably wander off.
Okay, is he known to like wander off?
I don't know. Sure.
You just don't want to go there?
No, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know the stories before I got there.
Okay, so then you start taking classes at Second City.
Yeah.
And you and then I.O.
Yeah.
And you say when you were at American University, you were like the funniest guy in college, right?
Sure.
Okay. And then... and Lumble,
I'm sure there are funnier people. But I mean, I was good. I felt confident in my abilities.
Right. So then you go to I.O., the first level... You're still the funniest guy. The second level,
yep.
The funniest guy. What happens in the third level?
Dan Backadall is in my class. They mm-hmm. merged our classes with the other level three, and Dan Backadall was in that class, and I was like, oh no, he's the funniest person I've ever seen, because he's such a good actor.
He's such a good actor.
He's such a good actor.
He's such a good improviser.
Oh my God, it was heartbreaking, but he's a very good friend, and I love him dearly.
So how do you deal with, how did you deal with that when that was going down?
Okay, I guess. I don't know. I probably took a step back from in my confidence. I probably hurt my confidence a lot. I wasn't asked on, to be on a lot of teams. I was asked like, hey, you want to do this team or this team? But everybody else in my class was being asked a lot more than I was by that point. But I did get put on a team in level three, so it wasn't bad. We all got put on teams back then in level three.
How do you deal with, because as you say this, is it fair to say you were jealous of Dan?
Not jealous.
Okay, because I'm super jealous.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not jealous. I love when my friends have success.
Okay.
I love it.
You're more evolved than I am.
Yeah.
Okay. I've said it many times. I turn it on myself. What am I doing wrong?
Sure. That's not jealousy.
What is that, self-hatred?
Yes. Okay. Jealousy is wishing them, like, not do well.
But don't you think we're all jealous? We all have...
Sure. I mean, we're all neurotic and we're all, you know, have confidence issues. And
Who are you jealous of?
Who am I jealous
of?
I don't wish anybody ill. I mean, I would
but
love...
But why is that wishing anybody ill?
To be jealous of
yeah,
somebody?
Yeah, you're saying, yeah, I'm jealous. It's like saying you're angry.
I think there's anger tied into jealousy.
I think you're right. But yeah. It's not about them. I don't think it's about them.
No, not at all.
It's about me. Like, if right. I'm jealous of Tina Fey. I mean, yeah. All her success and, you know.
Yeah, Jason, Jordan, Seth, I mean, they're all very famous now, and mm-hmm. I would love to be working with them or for them. You know, that'd be great. I think I'm more jealous of the people working for them.
Why are you more jealous working for, jealous to, like, Jordan Peele, Jason today? Because who else is
Seth,
you?
Seth Meyers. Sure.
What do you mean, work, like, writing for them?
And? Yeah, sure. Like, I would love... Because I got to work with all of them, and they're all so good. I wish I got to be still doing that, because they're great.
Would you ever think about, like, calling up Seth and say, hey, Seth, I heard someone's leaving. Would you smile when I say
that? Yeah, I think all of them know that I live in Austin. If they wanted to hear from me, they would. They all have my email and my Twitter handle. It's not like I'm not hiding.
But don't you have to submit a writing packet and stuff
sure,
like that?
Yeah.
You would not. You wouldn't call him and say, "Hey, how about a job?" Or "How about could I submit for your show?"
Yeah, maybe I will.
Okay. All right. Then you after you're taking IO, what's so funny?
No.
Okay. Then, is this uncomfortable for you?
No. It's not. I mean, it's uncomfortable, but it's not painful.
Okay. Tell me when it's painful.
I will.
Okay. Are you nervous about this interview?
No. Yeah, of course I am.
Okay, what is your fear about?
What is my fear about? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. Well, if it comes up during the interview, let me know. Okay. So then you start taking classes with Mick Napier.
Yes.
Okay. And you said you took them at least 12 times.
That might be an exaggeration, but it was up there.
Okay.
I took them a lot.
And one of the things you struggled with, and Mick helped you mm-hmm. with, was you had a hard time taking notes.
Yes.
We've never discussed this all this note-taking, hard time. Yeah. So can you tell us what you struggled with in terms of taking notes?
It's very interesting to me because I am very comfortable with giving notes now. Mm-hmm. I think I have a reputation for giving straightforward, hard notes that people seem to like. Mm-hmm. And I think back then I had a hard time hearing notes. Like, not like taking them, but just mm-hmm. like even like having them go in one ear and they would go right out the other. Like, I just would not retain them.
Like, say, it was after show, I'm your coach or director, and I say, Dave, you needed to agree more in that scene. Where what would happen then?
I go, yeah. But I wouldn't be listening. Like, I wouldn't be listening. Like, I would go through the motions mm-hmm. of what that would look like listening, mm-hmm. but I don't think I was actually listening.
What were you saying in your head when they
this is
you
so
know.
Much fun. I can't believe I'm in Chicago doing shows. This is amazing. I can't wait to go get high and go start hanging out with people. That's what
and
I've
so
been
the note
about.
Would just
the note would just go, and I don't think I stopped getting better
because of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how do you take feedback now and get notes?
Oh, I yearn for it. I don't get it a lot. I teach a lot of classes and coach a lot. I don't get a lot of notes these days, but I yearn for them. When, you know, Mick came down, I took his class. You know, when Joe Bill comes down, I take his class because I want those notes. I want those notes.
So then as a director, what is it like when you deal with someone who were like you and couldn't take feedback?
Everybody, I think it's about... Everybody on a troop has a different way of hearing something. There's a way to get everybody. And I think younger coaches don't realize that when you have a team of eight people, you have eight different ways that you need to communicate these notes, potentially. And I don't think a lot of younger coaches or directors know that or care to, you know, they make very general statements like, let's all try to pay attention out there. So this person made an offer, nobody, like, very rarely was anybody calling anybody out the way you just did. In a note session, it was very all. It's always so very general, and I have a hard time with that because, you know, let's. I mean, yes, this person made this mistake. That's something we're going to learn from. But let's all go back to that moment that it happened. You know what I mean? I forgot what we were originally talking about.
What happens when people don't take notes, like you did?
Yeah, they don't get better. I don't.
And let's say here's you're working with a team. You've given the note. You've given the note to somebody. 5, 10, 15 times, and they're just not taking the note. They're just like you were when you were in Chicago. It just,
I'd pull them aside and ask them, you know, I've given you this note 5 or 6 times. Is there something that we could be doing? And I usually what I'll do now, I've kind of grown into this, is come up with an exercise where they can feel it better than me telling them. Because a lot of people will not hear it when you tell them. And those people need to experience a win in that side of improv. So you develop an exercise, and my classes are about developing exercise specifically for the people that are in there and what they need to be working on. So I will come up with an exercise. I will improvise a whole class based on the people that are in that class and work on exercises that will reinforce that so they can find it themselves rather than me telling them.
Then you become an assistant director when you're still in Chicago at the main stage with Mick.
Yes.
What do you learn about directing from Mick?
I learned about set list, running order, time management in your rehearsals, how to talk to actors, how to get actors in your show to do what you need them to do.
How do you do that? Because Mick has got a very there's a psychology behind what
he's doing. Knows the frequencies of each of his actors in that room and how they respond to different things, and he will walk them up to the point of them discovering it themselves. And watching him deal with those strong personalities in the room, those are all alpha people. To get to the main stage of Second City, you got to be an alpha person. I went to a game night with those folks.
Game night is what?
We were late in the rehearsal process, and like, let's go hang out at Steph Weir's house. And we're all like playing games, like spoons and cards and celebrities. And to watch these people play these parlor games with no stakes whatsoever, and the determination that they all had to win... with the same determination that they must have had to win the main stage slot. Do you know what I mean? On some level, they're all alpha people that they have to win. They were at the top of the game. So even a small game like that, they're going to play hard.
So what is the secret that you that you learned from Mick to get an actor to do what?
Talk to them. Find out what's going on with them. Ask about their process and what they're doing. Help them rule out all the other options so that they're crossing off those options and the only one left is your idea.
So do you let the actor go and do his idea until you get down to your idea?
Well, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about why it worked and why it didn't work. And if their idea is better, I'll defer to them. If they're getting into it in a different place, but you know, I kind of want them to discover it on their own so that they can internalize it and walk away with a win that they... got, not because I handed them a win.
And it's important that they discover it, right?
Absolutely.
Why is that?
Because that's how they're going to grow. They're going to feel. It's a muscle memory.
Then, as being an assistant director at the main stage, you get hired to direct Boom Chicago. And you were really thrown into the fire.
Yeah.
And you said you really weren't good at this when you started.
I wasn't.
Why weren't you very good at it?
I didn't have experience. I mean, I directed a couple plays. And I watched Mick put up a show, but this was a huge budget with people who are my heroes. I got hired with one of my heroes, Bumper Carroll.
Okay.
You know, we got hired in the same month.
And when you say he was one of your heroes, you watched him perform.
I would go watch every Wednesday, and like, that guy's amazing. And now I'm his director.
And you have to tell him what to do.
Yeah, and I didn't know my vocabulary wasn't good. You know, I would say, give notes like, that was really dumb. And I remember Bumper pulling me aside, like, you can't call me dumb in a notes rehearsal. I was like, that's an excellent point. I shouldn't do that. And so those kind of things, like, you know, I just needed the experience, but I was on the job learning that experience.
And so how long did it take you to figure out the job?
6 or 7 months. It took me a long time.
Was that a hard time for you? Because you're not only, you're in Amsterdam, you're in a foreign country.
Yeah.
And now you're like, oh my, and they left you alone basically, didn't they?
Yeah. The artistic director I went out to be the assistant to left 2 months in. So I was the assistant to nobody for 6 months. So I was the assistant director to the artistic director, acting as the acting artistic director.
And so how did you become better at directing? Because nobody's there telling you.
Yeah, I just kind of had to find my way. I had to practice with running orders. And, you know, luckily we had shows every night of the week. So, I mean, every night was a new show. And I got... The learning curve happened within about 6 or 7 months.
So after 2.5 years there, you come back to Chicago.
Yeah.
And what happens at Boom Chicago?
What happens at Boom Chicago?
Yeah, because they make you the artistic director.
Yeah.
And you must have found your way.
Yeah. Yeah, it was good. One of the owners had left to do some stand-up in L.A. He wrote on Weekend Update for a season and had come back and kind of wanted his old job back. And the owners of Boom Chicago, Andrew, Pep, and Ken, they all grew up together and started the company together. So the artistic director came back and wanted his job back, and I was out the door.
How'd you deal with that?
Terribly.
And when you say terribly, what does that mean for Dave? What is Dave?
A lot of passive aggressiveness, probably.
At the end there?
Yeah, they let me stay another 3 or 4 months as I got my affairs in order.
Were you stealing office supplies?
No. But I remember coming back and to nothing, and I didn't really know. Everybody I had come up with was kind of moved on or on stages at that point. And I went back and read some of my emails I would send back to the Boomcast. They're so passive aggressive and so angry.
Give me an exact example.
Oh my God, it's excruciating to read these emails. I'm so embarrassed by them. But just like, woe was me, and life's not so good, and
I'm the victim, and they're screwing me.
I would have been
right with you.
Yeah, but not like. It was very passive aggressive. It wasn't like outright like that, but it was obviously
I'm aggressive.
Very painful.
Yeah.
It was very pain, spoken from a lot of pain.
You didn't try to get, like, I would have tried to, like, let's get the cast together and try to save my job.
No. Okay. No. I had meetings with each and every one of them, what they know was happening. It was very graceful. And, yeah. Nice.
So then you come back here.
Yeah.
Okay, so you lose that job.
Yeah.
And it's devastating.
Dream killer.
Okay, dream killer. All right. So you have and then you get hired by the touring company in Second City.
Yes.
And what are you thinking about now? So you've been devastated. You come back to Chicago.
Second City and Boom Chicago did a stage swap. It was the second time they'd ever done that. So I directed a show that ran for a week in the main stage of Second City.
With the Boom Chicago cast.
With the Boom Chicago cast. I stayed. And then they gave me a touring company a couple months later. And it was great. I was like, oh my, this is why I came back to Chicago. This is, I'm on top of the world, and you know, get to delve in all the archives and read all these scripts. And I found the running order from the first Second City show I'd ever seen, and like the actual producer's notes from that show.
What was that show? The first one you ever saw?
It was in George Washington University Lisner Auditorium. It was Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Ali Farnakian. Bill Cott, Rachel Hamilton, I want to say, and Michael McCarthy, Pat McCarthy?
Pat, oh, I can
McCartney?
See.
No.
Patrick McCartney.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That,
Blue Coat
all, that is a great cast. There's not one weak link in that cast.
They did a montage, a long form montage in the middle of the second act. It was probably the first long form I'd ever seen in my life. It was great.
And you found that running order.
I found that running order, still have it.
And so now you're here, it's Second City, you're back in Chicago, you're doing touring company. What are you hoping for?
on stage. I want to direct an ETC show or a main stage show, and that's kind of what I'm going for.
And then what happens with this touring company?
We go on a USO tour around Italy and Greece and Macedonia.
How long have you been how long have you been directing these
I've
guys?
Been directing these guys, I think a year, mm-hmm. and then I went to Cleveland to direct a show, mm-hmm. and then I came back and did this tour with mm-hmm. them. And it wasn't a good tour because I was changing the running order on them every night, I think, to justify why I was on this tour with them, and they fired me when I got back.
And so Kelly and Beth call you into the office,
yep.
and what do they say to you?
They say, we're going to let you go. Do you want to know why? And I said, no. And I said, okay, that's it. Thank you.
What do you think about that now, not asking them?
It haunts me. It haunts me to this day.
Why does it haunt you?
I don't know what the fuck I was thinking in that moment to not want to hear why I was, like, losing my dream job. Like, just to have something to, like, walk away with, like, let's fix that. But I wasn't ready to hear how I could be fixed.
Because it's interesting, Bumper gives you a note and
yeah.
says, you can't call me dumb in rehearsal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then they're willing to give you notes, and then there's like...
Yeah.
Did you ever think, like, after, like a month or two after, hey, I'm going to call him up and find out?
It took me 10 years to ask Kelly what happened.
What did he tell you?
Ask one of the actors.
What do you mean ask one of the actors? That's what he said?
Yeah. He gave me the name of one of the actors to go ask.
Who did he get?
I don't want to say.
Okay. Did you call the actor?
I haven't had the balls.
What is?
It's like 12 years ago. You know, like, what could he say? I had a bad tour. I complained about you.
Okay, I don't need to know the guy's right. name. Of course, I do, but I'm letting you. When you heard who it was,
mm-hmm.
did it make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
And what is your theory?
I wasn't as good as them. I wasn't as good as the directors. They were performers at the time, and they deserved somebody a lot more who had their act together at the time.
What
you they're said, operating on a different level than I was.
They were more they had more experience.
Not that they had more experience. They were just better at their job than I was at mine.
How does that feel to admit that now?
I've come to terms with that. That's why I wasn't. My talent, I got jobs before I had the talent that those jobs deserved. I have that talent now because I cultivated it, and I'm 25 years in. But at the time, I wasn't as good as I should have been.
I just want to go back to the Kelly thing for just a second.
Sure.
Did you call him? Did you go into his office? Did you just email
I
him?
I went up there to Chicago and kind of like, hey, you know, hey, what's going on? And kind of popped my head on some offices and... yeah, I just, you know, I was like, hey. And he called me in his office, and we just had a nice catch-up chat and said, listen, I got to ask you this. This is a weird question. I'm going to go back 10 years on you and ask you about this. He had no idea, but he kind of remembered vaguely. You know what I mean?
Right.
He didn't know the details.
Right. He probably did. You've been haunted by it. He It's just another day in his life.
Exactly. I mean, how many touring companies... directors
yes,
has
right,
he fired
right
you know
right.
He's gonna remember why he fired me
right or you know how many actors have gone in and complained about directors
exactly
right
yeah
did Rachel help you make that decision? How'd you come to that decision
to
go and if I see Kelly I'm gonna
I wouldn't have had the balls until I met Rachel. I don't know if Rachel told me I gotta go do that.
Okay,
but I'm sure I wouldn't have had the balls to do that until I met Rachel. Rachel's bigger than I would have the balls to do that at all.
How has she helped you with your balls? Meaning confidence.
Yeah. She's so good at common sense and asking for what you want. You know, like trying to get what you want. I mean, she's so good.
And tell us how you guys met.
So Second City sent me out to Cleveland to direct a show. In the first week of rehearsals, one of the actresses got sick and was out. And one of the understudies went in. And her father got sick, and she was out. And then the producer, Maria Carell, went in. And her father got sick, and she was out.
So nobody wanted that job.
Well, somebody could do it.
Yeah.
Rachel was the understudy for the third actress, for the other two actresses, but not this one. So mm-hmm. Rachel learned the show in a night. She went in, and we've been together ever since.
What was the first date? So you're the director, right?
I'm the director. She's an understudy.
Did you feel a little weird?
Very
about
taboo.
No, it is, isn't it?
It is. It was very taboo.
Were you? Did you have like, oh god, this isn't
yeah,
right?
They introduced me to the understudies. I'm like, this is Rachel. I was like, oh shit, because I fell in love with her immediately. And it's like the last thing you want to do as a director in your first week of rehearsals,
right.
This big new awesome job that they're giving you.
Right.
Right.
So then, how did you ask her out?
We just knew that we were attracted to each other and had to hide it for a while. I think we...
Was that hard?
It was hard.
Do you think other people were picking up on it?
We were very quiet about it.
Like, how sneaky were you?
One night there was a fire alarm in the hotel, and one of the other actresses that... And it was like knocking on our door, like, you coming down the... I was like, yeah, I'll be down there in a second. So we got to wait a couple of minutes. So there's moments like that, but it was, you know... After the when the show opened, we decided it was okay to be a couple.
So you met Rachel, mm-hmm. and now you're still in Chicago because you're having a... There's a long... what do they call it?
Long-distance relationship.
Long-distance. For a year. Write that down.
LTR.
LTR. I'm writing that down.
For a year.
And you're... You've been fired by Second City.
Yep.
And how do you take that?
Another dream killer in 2 years. It was hard. It was very hard. And I was like, well, there's no other reason for me to be in Chicago.
Was that harder than Boom?
Yeah.
In what way?
Because I grew up wanting this Second City job.
Mm-hmm.
And Boom Chicago, I didn't hear about until I moved to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So Second City was like, you know, that was the goal.
So you... Nothing to do in Chicago.
Right.
Now, what do you do?
I moved to Cleveland.
And what's the mission to go to Cleveland?
Get Rachel out of Cleveland.
Great. How long does it take you to get Rachel out of Cleveland?
9 months.
How do you get Rachel out of Cleveland?
I move in with her, and we start making plans. We made a list, a pro-con list for L.A. or Austin.
Now, why'd you decide those two cities?
Because we were done with snow and cold weather,
mm-hmm.
and we wanted an arts community and preferably something with improv.
Mm-hmm. And so how did the pros and the cons line up against Austin and L.A.?
We were in our mid-30s, and we didn't want to struggle. We just wanted a nice life. We wanted to do shows, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't want to, like, wait to do shows or kiss someone's ass to do. We just wanted to do shows. And
that was your goal at that
time?
That
was my goal at the time, yeah. In warm weather.
What about, like, TV and film? Did you throw that? You're not going to do that anymore at this point?
At that point, you know, I'd always been scared. I didn't get an agent until last year.
Okay.
Because I was always... not confident in my abilities. I didn't think I was that good. I knew I had interest in it. I didn't think I was that good of an actor to be on camera.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, well, I'm sure there's opportunities down there, but mm-hmm. I didn't want
to. Because you said something to me when we were doing the pre-interview that I think not going back to Chicago, you wish you would have gone to New York or something.
Oh, yeah, sometimes I really regret not going to New York instead
so
of Chicago.
So after getting fired from Boom, going to New York instead of Chicago?
Right.
And why was that?
I just felt like that would have been a step forward. In
mm-hmm.
Chicago, looking back on it, felt like a safe step backwards
because mm-hmm.
I'd already been there and done that, you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? And I feel like if I had gone to New York, I mean, I might not have ever met Rachel, which would have been a shame, but it would have been probably career-wise probably the right move at that
mm-hmm.
point.
So then you guys move here,
mm-hmm.
and you start out at the Hideout.
Yeah.
It's about 2006.
2005.
2005, and then the Hideout spins off to Cold Town in 2006.
Yeah, Cold Town was a troupe that moved here from New Orleans mm-hmm. after Katrina. They were Katrina evacuees. And they showed up on the weekend of the Out of Bounds Festival.
Mm-hmm.
They were similar to us in our sense of humor and our training.
Mm-hmm.
Me and Rachel and these other couples, Jen and Aaron, who are now in Seattle, and Bob and Erica, who are now in the Frank Mills.
Bob and Erica, they were also out of I.O. Chicago.
Exactly,
right.
Right.
So it's kind of the I.O. people kind
the
of
I.O. people
each
kind of found each other in Austin, in this narrative world.
Okay. Narrative world meaning John Stonian,
narrative-based, genre-based improv, yeah.
Do we know why John Stonian stuff started here? Because certainly I can understand.
Some folks who started the scene here had gone to San Francisco and trained with Keith Johnstone.
And they came here.
They came back and started their work.
So as you come here to Cold Town now and make this your home,
yeah.
It was very important that you tell people to study with other people and work at other theaters.
Yeah.
Why was that so important to you?
Because I had seen what it's like in other cities where people are very closed off in their communities and their theaters. Most cities only have one style of improv, and that's it. Narrative, short form, long form, Chicago style. Or if there is more than one theater, they forbid their students from talking to other theaters or performing there or learning. And it seems so stupid to shunt somebody else's education and growth because of your own ego, because you're scared you're going to lose them and everything's going to go away. And I think the people that were here at that time in 2005 really wanted to go that extra mile and make sure that that didn't happen here. We all took classes from each other. We all learned from each other. We all shared bills. And when theaters started popping up, we wanted our troops to go play at the other theaters to foster the city to be an improv community, not just these silos.
And you guys started this Thanksgiving dinner. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. In 2006, 30 of us got 30 improvisers in Austin got together and had a potluck dinner.
And this is from all the theaters?
Well, we were all at the Hideout at the time. Okay. At the time. We've been growing that ever since, and now it's over 300-400 people going to that thing.
And from all over.
Anybody that considers himself an improviser. And you know.
And everybody gets along, all five theaters?
For the most part, yeah.
Okay. Now, the audience laughs. Mm-hmm. Why do you think the audience laughs?
Well, there's always some drama.
Okay. You know,
there's always some online drama. Mm-hmm. You know, the way New Movement split up in Coal Town, there was wasn't very acrimonious mm-hmm. split at all. But I think in the years since then, you know, people have forged those relationships, and now it's much more communal than it's ever been.
So, in a very short period of time, I think, Austin has become, I think it's the fourth biggest improv market after Chicago, New York, and L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it keeps growing?
There is a hybrid of tech nerds from Facebook, IBM, Google, mm-hmm. National Instruments, all these tech nerds that move here with money to spend. Mm-hmm. About 25,000 new UT freshman students every year.
University of Texas.
Yep. And then you got all these poets and artists and musicians and looking to create, expand their craft.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a hotbed of people who would be drawn to improv anyway, but there's a never-ending influx of students.
And then, like in Chicago, people were doing it, you know, to get Main Stage, Second City. People in Austin, why are they doing it?
For fun. it's the most fun you can have. And I think people are very dedicated to finding what is next in improv. Like, what is next? Where is the edge? How can we put up a show that lives on the edge?
And spending time in Chicago and Austin, how do those communities compare to each other?
I have a lot more real conversations here.
What do you mean real conversations?
Like off stage, like, you know.
Like what we're doing now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but not in front of a microphone.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I think I always found myself in these circles of guys in Chicago that just wanted to do bits mm-hmm. and not connect. You know what I mean? Just like, let's just do bits. We'll find a bit. We'll just play with it for a half an hour. And it always bored the shit out of me.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't good at it. I liked having real conversations off stage and eye contact. And I think there's a wonderful community of artists here that are into that kind of connection with each other.
And is it part of it because there isn't a prize here like there is in Chicago?
Yeah, there's no industry here.
And how does that help the work and how does that hinder the work?
How does that help the work and hinder the work? I think it helps the work because we're not focused on getting discovered from this show. So, you know, someone might see a show and we might get like a short film or maybe a web series. You know, that'd be great. You know, that's happened to me lots of times here. Someone's seen a show. So it helps the work, and that's not what our focus is. Our focus is this show right now, right here with you. And how it hurts is, you know, I don't think it hurts. It just kind of keeps us all doing it for free.
So there's an aspect of the art isn't going to be affected. We're doing it for the art, right?
Right.
But also, we aren't going to get paid for it right now.
Right.
Is that, for this community to grow, does money have to come into play?
No, it doesn't have to. I think it will.
Okay.
I think there will be a couple movies made with some folks that are doing improv here. I think a couple people from our community will be famous, and that'll be great for the people that are doing it here then. But right now, it's just we're doing it for the love.
So what would you tell somebody, what is the advantage to coming to Austin to study before you would go to a major market, a Chicago, an L.A., or a New York?
You will be such a well-rounded improviser by the time you finish all five schools in Austin. I don't think anybody.
I know you write for the Chamber of you work for the Chamber of Commerce of Austin, but I really think that there should be a branch that because that was so like that. Talk about a great way to sell Austin's improv community. You just did it.
Yeah, absolutely. That you, it's like coming to a university town. It'd be like going to. You know, up in upstate New York, there's like Syracuse, Cornell, and Ithaca. All right, you can go to all three of them and get 3 degrees.
Or if you're like us, we get kicked out of all three of them.
Exactly.
So, what would I learn really quickly at each school?
At each school,
Coaltown.
Coaltown. How to be funny.
Okay. institution: Tom Booker and Asa Ferronin.
How to believe in yourself.
Okay. New movement.
Introduction to industry.
Okay. What the other two? What help me?
The hideout.
The hideout.
You learned narrative and genre.
Great. And the fifth one?
Merlin Works, short form and narrative.
Okay. And speaking of short form and narrative, and speaking of improv, we are now going to improvise.
Yes.
Okay. And we and what do you like to do in terms of your in terms of improv?
I like to do relationship based scenes.
Okay. Is that from your IO training?
Yeah. Sure. It's just what I like to do. I like to connect and have a real scene with somebody.
And you know, when you say connect and have a real scene, what is it that you mean?
Eye contact. We're talking like two people would actually talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if something funny comes along, that's great. Let's play with that. But mm-hmm. I'm not like looking for the premise.
Right. And you don't care. Do you do a lot of scenes where it's like, oh, it's not funny, and it was just very conversational? And
No. I mean, yes, but I think I'm experienced enough to know where the funny is and how to lead us there.
Okay. Good, because you're going to have to help me out.
Okay.
Okay. So we'll take us. We're going to do like a scene, a series of scenes. We'll
sure.
decide. Okay. We'll call it two.
Okay.
And can we get a suggestion? Do you want a suggestion?
Sure.
Okay, great. Can we have a suggestion?
Spice.
Now you hear spice. What goes on in your process in terms of starting off a scene?
Spice. So I'm thinking of a spice rack.
Okay.
I like to cook a lot, so I'd probably start cooking in the scene immediately and start. Probably.
So you go right to environment?
Yeah, usually.
Okay.
I think so.
Okay, great. Let's do it.
Okay. Thank you, Pierre.
You're welcome.
Pierre, did you taste this?
Yes, I did.
You did?
Yeah.
This is how you want it to taste?
Yeah, with a hint of cinnamon.
This is better than your last batch?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Ooh, you. Yes.
Pierre, you don't have to be scared of me.
I am not scared of you.
You're acting scared of
I
me.
Would, we have a lot of... I'm terrified of you. Last night, you, Carlos, you hit him in the head with that frying pan.
I'm sorry you had to see that. It was not my intention for you to see that. Carlos.
Yes.
You don't have to back. I'm not going to hit you.
That's what you said to Carlos.
I know. Almost verbatim, too. But I have no intention of laying hands on you.
Okay.
Here.
Great. When I talked to you after you hit Carlos, you said that you were on drugs. That's what you did.
Yeah, I was on a lot of drugs.
Are you on drugs now?
Yeah. I don't want to lie to you.
That's good.
Yeah. I had... I had some pills.
I know, I saw the Valium.
You saw the Valium.
You said that's for your wife, but she doesn't ever come in here.
Yeah.
You lie.
I do. I'm glad we're having this conversation.
Good.
Pierre?
Yes?
Would you like a Valium? You're allowed to.
It might help you relax.
Okay. I'll have a Valium.
You've been in the industry for a long time.
Why, yes. For 20 years when I came over from the country.
What country was that again?
I came from Venezuela.
Oh, Venezuela.
Yes.
I went there once. With my wife.
Well, why does Miss Susan not come in?
She does not like my food. She prefers to eat elsewhere.
Well, that is not right. This is your restaurant.
Well,
it's your name on the sign.
Yeah, I know, but she's not a supporter of what I'm trying to do.
Oh.
I mean, she's a great woman.
No, she's
take the value.
Thank you.
It'll help you.
Help me.
In the kitchen.
In the kitchen.
You'll find a zone.
Zone.
Do you know what your zone feels like, Pierre? Have you ever been in a zone?
I don't know zone.
The zone is when you're not judging yourself.
Oh, that's very good.
Yeah.
That's very good. What did you do to
it? 15 minutes, it's going to get great.
No, no, no. The taste is very good. It's very...
It's cherry flavored.
But you know, it's almost like, you know the sauce you put on the tort, you know? It is chocolatey, but light.
It's hazelnut.
Yes, that is it. It's hazelnut.
Yes.
With a little nutmeg.
Yeah. I don't... When I get a jar of Valium, I don't accept... It's just a starter. I like to enhance my Valium.
Oh, my God, this is delicious. You should put this on the menu.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Who would pay money for him?
I've got to sit down. I can't feel my legs.
Yeah, that'll pass.
We've got a big party of 14 coming in.
I can't wait.
Oh, my God.
I can't wait for them to be here.
Oh, God.
Pierre.
Yes.
Are you going to be able to finish your shift?
Oh, yes, I will. Rub my stomach. Just rub it. You know...
It's okay. It's okay.
When I was 4 years old, my father died.
Oh, my God, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yes. I cried like a baby, you know? Because I loved my father.
Every boy should love his father.
Yes, I did not have a father, you know. Sometimes I think you're my father, you know. I look up to you like a father.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
That's very sweet, Pierre. I've come to think of you as one of my kids.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Would you kiss me on the forehead like my father? The last memory I have of my father... He kissed me on the forehead before he put me to bed. And then I heard. My mother woke me up. She said, "Your father, he's dead. He had a heart attack in the bed."
It's terrible.
Yes.
Sure. Do we really have to finish this?
Yes, we'll finish it. Thank you, Father.
You're welcome.
We have to finish this.
Yeah. So just, as best you can, just stand and finish these sauces.
Yes. Sauces.
It's okay. Hey, Pierre.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be perfect tonight.
Yes.
Okay?
Okay.
Can you hear me?
I hear you.
It doesn't have to be perfect.
It doesn't have to be perfect.
However it goes, that's the way it's supposed to go.
Right.
Okay?
Yes. You know, I like a spoon. I like a spoon more than I like a fork.
That's a good spoon.
It's a wooden spoon.
Yeah.
I'm going to use the wooden spoon and the fork. Together.
You do you, Pierre.
I want you to taste this. I made this. Taste it.
Yeah, that is delicious. You know what that reminds me of?
My father. That is the recipe for my father.
It reminds me of the south of France.
Yes, he was French.
The buttery orange.
There is marmalade in there, and a little orange peel. Mm-hmm.
Here.
Yes.
You just taught me something.
Really?
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right.
My father never said that to me.
Father sounds like an asshole.
You know what? He was not a nice man.
No, I bet he wasn't.
I had a younger brother. We called him Mo. His name was Maurice. Mm. He had a bad leg, you know? Polio. My father, he would wake him up. He would call him a cripple. And then he would hit him with a frying pan. For no reason. Carlos asked for it. Maurice was just helpless. Helpless child.
Why are fathers such assholes? Why do they have the need to be assholes? It's not fair.
No. I'll get back to work.
Yeah.
Yes.
I want you to stay here for a while. I know you've been looking at other jobs. I know you don't lie.
I have been looking at other jobs. I can take your temper sometimes.
I know.
I don't know when you were going to be violent and when you're going to be loving, right? Like right now. I'm scared. I'm scared to stay here. I know why Susan doesn't come here. You'd say it's the food. It's your attitude. It's who you are. You can be a jerk.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know you haven't been living.
I'm working on it. Yeah. I'm fucking working on it. Okay? Sorry. I did it again.
Yeah. But this time you caught yourself.
I did.
You did not pick up a frying pan and try to hit me over the head with it.
No.
And blame the pills. I will stay here. Because I like it.
And I'll make you a deal. If I ever hit you with a frying pan, I won't be angry if you leave.
And I'll make you a deal. If you ever hit me with a frying pan, I will call the police. See.
How'd you feel about that?
It was good. What'd
you like about it?
What I liked about it was connecting with you and how the pacing of it, and it was slow, and I had time to think about things and consider things. Those are the things I liked about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Anything you would have done differently?
Yeah. I would have picked up a lot sooner on your clues about like my temper. I never got to my temper until the end.
Okay.
And I realized about halfway through, like, shit, he's been setting me up to be he's opened the door for my temper this entire scene, and I haven't walked through that door once. And
okay.
It wasn't until after that late moment that I
So well, how would you have played it differently?
Oh, I would have gone back and forth between anger and nice the entire scene. Maybe while I had my hand on your belly, I would have punched you.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like, something like I would have found some games to just sharply gone to anger and nice.
Okay. I don't know. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed
you.
It.
I had a good time, too.
I really did. And I liked the pacing of it and the thinking. I was changing my accent a little.
That's fine.
What do you tell people when they lose their accent?
I tell people that it's improv and the audience knows that it's improvised and they'll forgive you.
Good. It's good to know that.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So let's take some questions from the audience.
Okay.
Either about what we did or about Dave or about Cold Town or about Austin Improv or about improv in general. So if we could, great, turn the lights up. Who's got a question for Dave? Who'd like to start?
I'll start.
Great.
You were mentioning that you didn't get into film because you weren't confident, you felt like you weren't confident enough in your abilities as an actor, mm-hmm. at least for film.
Yeah.
What was it that made you change your mind about that?
Rachel and I have been circling around trying to get an agent. We had a specific agent we wanted.
Here in town?
Here in town. She represents all of our good actor friends. And we wanted to really choose the right one. I've been approached a lot of times in Austin for agent. I just never found the right one that was like, I met with a couple of them and I was just like, I don't want you representing me out there. It was more, and I was getting plenty of work from my friends who would like throw me a you know, non-union, whatever, just, you know, hey, would you do this? And I had gotten a lot of work that way. And eventually it got to the point where I was like, I bet if there's somebody out there looking for me, I'd probably be making a lot more money doing this.
Great. Also, I want to ask you about confidence, because yeah. it's such a, you know, they always say, like, in comedy, confidence is like 90% of that. You said you've gotten more confident and stuff like that.
Yeah.
How have you been able to build your confidence?
It's just the reps. I feel like I don't feel scared of being on stage at all, ever. I don't feel scared of doing shows like this anymore. So I think, like, I've gotten out of my head about, like, I hope this goes well. I hope the audience likes me. That's not a factor in my fear anymore. So I'm not improvising from a place of fear anymore. And now I feel like I can walk into an audition room and kill. It feels so much better now than it did even 3-4 years ago.
How, Rachel is a psychologist.
Therapist.
Therapist. How has she helped you in terms of your mental health, in terms of improv, performing, and teaching?
Well, she's a great confidence booster. She helps me process a lot. We process shows together. We process classes together.
Give me an example of how you process a show. Because you perform with her in Frank yep. Mills. You guys do a two-person show.
Yeah. We just talk about the scenes, and we're very honest about what worked and what didn't work. And there are those moments where I'm just like, I don't want to talk about the show anymore. But she's like, no, let's figure it out. Let's make sure that doesn't happen again. You know. So eventually those kind of moments get fewer and fewer.
What about in terms of teaching? How do you process that with her?
We kind of talk to each other about our classes before we go teach them, and afterwards how it went, and you know, if there's any lessons that we could take away, with like issues with students or scenes, or how do you handle the situation? It's just good to process that as you would a show with somebody.
Great. Another question for Dave. Yeah, right here.
You mentioned the difference between the improv scene in Chicago versus here in mm-hmm. Austin, that it in Chicago it seems like it's more, you know, working towards the career, towards professional showtime on stage and such, and here, of course, we're all doing it pretty much for free and because we want to. Do you have a fear that it will change towards that?
Well, I think a lot of people are doing it in Chicago for free as well.
Yeah.
I think eventually there will be a lot of attention on this scene. We're probably 2 or 3 years from someone in this community being very famous.
Are you afraid it's going to corrupt it, though? Or it's going to change it in the wrong way?
It's going to be awesome. It's going to be awesome.
Are you serious about that?
Yeah.
So let's say, like, in 2 years, people who are doing shows here at Cold Town are getting paid. You're making a huge living at this.
That's not going to happen.
Okay. But I'm just saying, let's say there is some money that's infused with it. Because think about the engine that drove Chicago was people were going to get jobs at Second City.
Yeah.
You know?
There are people moving to Austin to take improv classes here now.
Right. But isn't that, if people start getting paid, isn't that going to help the community?
Yeah, of course, because mm-hmm. some of us will have some money, and we'll be able to hire our friends. I mean, every person I met, when I was at IO, I knew everyone was never going to walk in and hire me out of the blue based on a show I saw. It was the relationships I was making with people that 10 years down the road, these are the people that will be helping us get jobs, you know, those connections. It's the same reason why you join a fraternity in college, is those connections. 5-10 years down the road.
Because I didn't know that. Did you know that 10 years when you started at IO?
Yes.
How did you have the insight of, like, you know what? I'm networking already.
Yeah, because I was in a fraternity, and that's what that is for.
Ah. I knew I should have gotten in a fraternity. Another question for Dave. Yes, back here.
So you said Cold Town teaches you how to be funny.
Yep.
What does that mean to you?
What does being funny mean to me?
What is Cold Town teaching people to be funny?
I think there's a meritocracy about Cold Town. The funniest rises to the top. And, you know, every 2 or 3 years, there's a new crop of really funny people that are coming up, and they kind of displace the people who have been doing it for a while. And, you know, it's not, I don't want to say displace, but, you know, it's, I think our classes are geared towards finding the funny. I think it draws the funniest people in Austin.
Great. We had another question right over here.
So you said you got a lot of those really big opportunities, those, like, dream job opportunities when you were young in your career.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think you were given those opportunities?
Connections. I mean, I had auditioned for Boom 3 years in a row, got called back 3 years in a row. They knew who I was. And then my roommate, Ike, got hired. So I had an in. And because of that, I got, you know, all those opportunities there. And because of all the things that I did at Boom, you know, people were going back and, you know, talking about me in Chicago. So it's all about who you've played with and who wants to go to bat for you.
Great. Another question? Yeah, right here.
What's your favorite improv life lesson?
My improv life lesson?
Yeah, you know, I mean, they both...
A lesson you could apply from improv to your life, your own life.
Try everything, say yes to everything, and don't judge anybody's choices.
How do you do that? Because I am the biggest judger. It is. How do you, like...
You say good for them. Good for them.
So you make a choice on stage or whatever.
It's the right choice.
Okay, and somebody...
You tell them that was the right choice. You tell yourself that was the right choice.
Even though you're judging it like a mile.
Yeah, one of the exercises I do in my classes is getting people on one side to do the worst improv they possibly can. And the other people who are having trouble saying yes and not judging, I put you in that category. I'd make you improvise with that person doing terrible improv and loving every choice, loving every choice that they make.
Okay, can we say do that right now?
Yeah, of course.
I'm the judging. Yep. I'm the guy who's judging. Perfect casting for
okay.
me. And you're just...
I'm going to do terrible improv, and your job is to say, in your mind, say, that's perfect. That's exactly... That's perfect. Exactly. He's probably right. You're going to treat me like I'm TJ.
Okay.
Okay?
TJ Jagodowski. So every choice you make is... it's just like it's...
He's probably right. You just say, he's probably right. That's probably the right thing to do.
Okay, great. Okay? Okay, let's do it for like a couple minutes.
Sure. What?
I came here because you wanted to see me, boss.
Fart knockers.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. The fart knockers. The fart knockers have. We didn't get them to the store in time, so
you're stupid.
I am totally stupid. Don't tell anyone. It's between us. I am stupid.
I live in a van down by the river.
I know that, Gerald. Your karate has gotten so much better since you've been taking that class. I just want to say it's great. And it looks like you've lost some weight, too.
No.
Okay, I'm sorry. I know you're a little sensitive about the weight thing. Forget I even said it. That looks like a lot of fun.
You got laughs nonstop.
Right. It was very hard for me to do.
Right.
Right.
It's a muscle memory. It's tricking your brain. It's just tricking your brain. The same way you would trick a brain to do real, honest, slow comedy.
Right.
That this is really happening to me, and I would react the way I normally would. You trick your brain into thinking this is TJ Jagodowski or Rush Howell or one of the best improvisers on the planet, and they're probably right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was very hard for me, but very helpful at the same time.
Yeah.
To me, I almost went into like a short form mentality.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit. That happened to me at a Second City callback.
Okay.
At a Second City audition. Mm-hmm. They paired me up with somebody who was literally doing Van Down by the River and Samurai.
You're kidding me.
This is to get into the Torco. Mm-hmm. And Mick pairs me up with this guy. And I'm like, what? This guy had never been on stage before. And I got a callback because I treated this guy like he was brilliant.
Okay. That was a very fun exercise. Another question for Dave. Yes.
Do you need laughs in every aspect of your life or just on stage?
No, I don't need laughs in every aspect of my life. I like to save it for stage, for classes, and for bit circles.
But you said you weren't a guy that liked doing bits.
No, but, you know, after 20 years, you know how to do a bit.
Okay. Great. Another question? Yes, right here.
What are some of the better ways you've found of really connecting with your crewmates or really a cast in general?
Eye contact, bonding experiences. I like to send my troops, when I'm coaching a troop, sometimes I'll send them out on a scavenger hunt instead of having a rehearsal, because I know that that will bond them for an evening, and they'll have an evening experience that they'll never forget. You know, I did a lot of those things. I pulled a lot of things. I was a pledge master in my fraternity for one time. I learned a lot of really cool things, and I used to do them with the Boomcast, and they loved it. So these kind of other kind of exercises that are more group team building bonding rather than just having an improv rehearsal. Sometimes.
What about drugs and drinking and mm-hmm. stuff like that?
Great. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. We got to wind this down.
Okay.
What's so funny?
Well, you're shocked that that's...
Well, you don't still do it today, do you?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not constantly stoned and drunk, but mm-hmm. I like to drink. I like to smoke.
Mm-hmm. But did you think you did more when you were starting out in Chicago?
Like, yeah.
Okay.
Would you have done 24 hours a day?
Would you have done less?
Yeah.
Why is that?
I probably because I think it interfered with my work.
In what way does it interfere with your work? If you're getting
it
high
became
all the
more
time?
Yeah, it became more important.
Getting high or yeah. drinking.
Yeah, and I would show up to work drunk and high.
Are you serious?
Sure.
Like in Second City and
yeah.
Rome?
Yeah.
How and did people ever call you on it or?
No.
How were you able to hide it?
Highly functioning.
Oh my God. Okay, I was never that lucky. Okay, so we got to wrap this up, but what do you think your contribution to the Austin improv scene is?
Well, I don't know. I started Thursday nights.
What is Thursday nights?
Doing shows on Thursdays.
Mm-hmm.
Doing shows on Fridays.
Mm-hmm.
The cage match. I mean, things that we did in Chicago. We did mm-hmm. shows on Thursday and Friday nights
right,
in Chicago.
Right.
I thought it might work here. I like build. Someone told me when I was moving, they found I was moving to Austin. They said, "Oh, you're going to go build an army down there," and I thought that was a joke. But I feel like we have. So we built an army of improvisers down here.
We end our show always with this question.
Okay.
What would you tell somebody who's getting into improv today? What one piece of advice would you tell them?
Make as many friends as you can. And don't judge yourself too much. Remember, make it fun for you.
And how do you make it fun for you? Because people will take improv really seriously,
yeah,
especially after a couple of years.
Yeah, those year three and four, they get so into it.
Right.
They get crazy into it. Yeah, it's not that important. There's always another show around the corner, and you'll get them next time. So, you know, the show didn't matter that much.
Dave Buckman, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thanks.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerds in the Can. We are just churning these things out, right? We're like a podcast factory over here. It's just great. I want to thank my guest, Dave Buckman, in Cold Town Theater. And I loved what he talked about Kelly Leonard and going back to him 10 years later and asking him. That was so courageous of him to talk about. I really, really appreciate it. Also, I want to really thank this time. I screwed it up last time because I called her Karen, but Shanae Hale and Joseph Daly are the musicians that you heard at the beginning of the podcast here. Great job, great people. And I owe an apology to Shanae because the last, we had three or four episodes we did from the Out of Bounds Comedy Festival in Austin, and I called her Karen. So I want to apologize. Her name is Shanae Hale and Joseph Daly. They're great, great musicians and great people. It was just so much fun to have live music there. So I think I've made my amends. Also, I want to thank my producer here in Chicago, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. Also, if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning Art of Slow Comedy Improv Intensives here in Chicago, I'll be offering them in July, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. My slick new website, make me feel good, jimmycorain.com. Also, follow us on social media. We are on Facebook, Improv Nerd. Like our page. It really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, Improv_Nerd, and over to our YouTube channel where you get to see actual clips from our recordings. We're also fortunate enough to be part of a wonderful podcast collective called Feral Audio. So go to feralaudio.com. That's feralaudio.com. I want to thank our sponsors today, the Acting Studio in Chicago. Just go to actingstudiochicago.com and the 13th Annual LA Improv Comedy Festival at IO West Theater in Hollywood. For more information, go to ioimprov.com/west. That's ioimprov.com/west. And of course, I couldn't do this without you. I'm saving the last person, the most important person, and that is you for listening. Without you, it would just be me in a basement doing this to my cat. My cat isn't a very good improviser. Not very bright either, actually. Until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my God.